Welcome to a World of Good podcast. I'm Nate Tapman.
And I'm Andrew Gale.
And we are two friends
who love Jesus,
care about the church,
and travel the world to share stories of people who do the same.
Our conversations happen in all kinds of places,
like a coffee shop in an airport terminal,
or even the back of a crowded taxi.
But no matter where we go, from Argentina to Zimbabwe,
we capture stories of the good God is doing around the world.
And we hope those stories will do you a world of good. Welcome to a World of Good podcast. My name is Andrew Gale, and for the first time in a month or so, I am in a Zoom room with my good friend and co-host, Nate Tapman. So grateful to see you in person. You are alive and well, it looks like, in Madrid, Spain.
Yes, I am alive. I guess I'm well. Doing well.
And you are in Madrid? That was the third point that I made.
Yes, I am in Madrid.
Because you've been
right
traveling.
I have been traveling, traveling for about 3 weeks, and we're back in Madrid, and I started back up in my language learning for Espanol, and it is just going at a snail's pace. So,
well,
I'm getting there.
Language learning takes time, but it's also culture learning,
which I think
it's one of the most important things you can do, I think, is learning language. I've been traveling as well. At the end of September, I was in Washington, D.C. with some missions leaders from around the country, having some really incredible conversations about travel and what do we do as missions leaders during this time to encourage our churches to engage when things are so different and difficult. And then after that, was home for a couple of days and then traveled to Pakistan for a week and got to visit the church there, and a really incredible experience, and recorded some podcasts that we'll be premiering later and sharing with the audience. And then from that, went on vacation for a week. So I wasn't even in the office for almost 3 weeks, which was very strange. It felt like we were going back to COVID times where you just work from elsewhere, you know, but it was good to be back with the folks in our office. We have an awesome staff, and good to be back with you, Nate.
Yeah. And do you have your coffee drink of choice this morning?
Yeah.
I guess it's morning for you, afternoon for me.
Yeah, so
what's your coffee drink?
I do have a coffee. It's just black coffee. This is what I do. And it's actually not anything that's, so my wife made it this morning. So I don't know what she made, but based on the taste, not that I can taste all of the notes, I'm pretty confident that she used one of our favorite Starbucks blends, which don't judge me for that. Cafe Verona. It's a good blend. But what I should have had today, if I had made coffee, I roasted recently a bean from Mexico, and our guest today spent lots of time in Mexico. So I actually had a coffee shop in Mexico. But I roasted a bean that's a Mexican bean. I tried to do a medium roast on it. I did lots of YouTube watching of how to do this medium roast on this bean, and I'm not sure that it should have. I think that it had a very unique flavor, and my wife did not enjoy it at all, which is why I'm very confident that this is Starbucks and not my Mexican blend. But I liked it. It was just a lot brighter and a little bit more in your face, which I don't mind my coffee like that.
Yeah. No, I don't either. My drink of choice right now is just water, plain old water.
Oh,
I'm trying to rehydrate, stay hydrated. But yeah, my coffee routine has been very normal, very boring. I wake up, and about an hour after I wake up, I have my first cup of coffee, and it's just regular black coffee made from the AeroPress. So
yeah, AeroPress is wonderful. I brought that with me to Pakistan. I had Mexico roasted coffee the entire time. Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah, it's great to travel with.
Especially since Pakistan is very much like India in the sense that they're very tea, chai, which was delicious. Yuck. And I enjoyed that while I was there.
Not in the morning, though.
But I needed my coffee, and the coffee they had was instant. And so bringing my own, it was the right move.
Good move.
I want to ask Gina. We're actually joined by Gina Thomas, and we're going to get to know her in just a second. But Gina, what's your coffee drink of? Do you drink coffee in the morning, and what's your drink of choice?
She's probably a tea drinker.
No, I am a huge coffee fanatic. So this conversation is like right up my alley.
All right.
Yeah. So like you said, we had a coffee shop in Mexico. It's still going now. But because of that, I have become quite a fanatic of coffee, and AeroPress is absolutely one of my favorites as well. I broke my hand grinder not too long ago. So when I traveled recently, I was like, this is awful. I can't get good coffee.
We're so spoiled,
aren't
we?
Oh my goodness, it's awful. Yeah. But so currently I'm drinking an Ethiopian from Camber coffee that roasts some really good coffee. So pumped about that. Yeah, this morning.
I like Ethiopian coffees. They're really fruity and bright. And but you have to roast them well. And that's one of the problems. I have a hard time getting a good medium roast on them in my roaster. So I end up getting them too dark and they don't have quite that really fruity flavor that they're supposed to have. I had an Ethiopian one time that tasted exactly like blackberries, blueberries. Blueberry. It was so good, but so bizarre. I was like, felt like somebody put blueberry extract in it.
Yeah. So coffees actually take on the essence of different things grown around them. And so in Ethiopia, this is the berry flavor, right? In Mexico, it's more earthy, you know, all the different kinds of things. And I had no idea. I didn't never knew that, but once we got into coffee shop stuff, we started learning all these things, but I love fruity coffees. They're my favorite.
One of the coolest experiences I had recently, when we were at this in DC for this round table with our missions leaders, we had the conference at, the meeting at, was called, it's Fairfax Church in Fairfax, Virginia. And they have a coffee shop in the church that's run by a guy named Ronnie Cruz, who's a brilliant coffee guy. And he did a tasting with us. We had to got to do a coffee tasting. Ooh. And I've done different coffee tastings before, but listen to how he did this. He took the same bean grown in the same farm. It was roasted the same way, but it was processed differently. Yeah. So one was dry processed, one was wet processed, and one was semi-dry processed. And then did a pour over of each of those different kinds. And it was crazy how different.
Yeah.
Literally the exact same bean. Yes. So different.
Very distinct flavor.
So trying to help us understand how the impact of how we process beans makes, and it was very cool. I had not done one quite like that.
Yeah, that's neat.
Well, we could go on talking about coffee, but we probably should actually talk about the purpose for having Gina join. We'll have to have you back and just have a coffee conversation.
Yeah,
I would enjoy that.
I was listening to some of your other podcasts and I was like, yeah, let's talk about coffee. This is great.
we like
you guys
coffee.
Are always talking about coffee.
We are.
It's awesome.
We are. It's the small talk we do is always coffee.
I like it.
Well, Gina Thomas, we're so grateful that you're joining us. For our audience, Gina Thomas is a writer, a speaker. She served the church. She served as a missionary in Mexico, in northern Mexico, for 4 years, is married and wrote a book. She's written a couple books that we recommend, A Smoldering Wick, which is a great book talking about short-term missions, which a lot of people use the term like impact trip or engagement trip, those short connections that we have. And how do we do healthy international development in the midst of that? And even has very practical resources in the back that are in English and Spanish, which is awesome for those that are serving in Latin America. But the book we're going to talk about today, she wrote a book recently called Separated by the Border, which is what she'll share about, but it's her experience of fostering during the family separation time in the United States. And so we're going to jump into that. But before we do, tell us a little about yourself. Where do you live now? Where do you work? Give us a picture of your family and so we can get to know you a little bit.
Yeah. So we just recently moved back from Chattanooga, Tennessee. We were living there for about 2.5 years. Moved back home to what we call home, North Carolina. We live right outside of Charlotte. And I have two kids, one who's 10 and in fifth grade, and then a little girl who's 6 in first grade. And have been married to my husband, Andrew, for 12 plus years now. So we're working on those golden years. And we have a dog and a cat and live in not too far from our downtown area. So we get to go walk to the library now, which is a whole different lifestyle for us. So we're really pumped about that. And then I work at World Relief and I'm a part of the immigration programs team there. So this experience certainly has had its own feet for me too. So grateful for that opportunity. Yeah. Just working on new books all the time. There's always something in my head to write out. It never goes away. And then, just living life, learning
awesome.
To love.
And you did. Well, first of all, for those that want to hear more about Gina, she did a whole piece, I think it was on ethical storytelling that we did as a webinar that you can find on our resources page, and we'll link to it in the show notes. And in there, you talk a little bit more about your time in Mexico. You served in northern Mexico for 4 years, is that right?
And that's right.
Just give us a really brief sketch of what your ministry was that you participated in there.
Yeah, so we initially went down there as teachers, my husband and I. We at the time didn't have any kids. Our son was born there and we taught English and my husband taught PE. And then that kind of turned into, figuring out how we could meet the needs of the community. And there's a very large climbing community in that area near Potrero Chico, which is a really big sport climbing spot for people know it all over the world. So people from all over the world come to that area to climb. And so we decided to start a coffee shop ministry there where we would kind of create a space for internationals that came climbing and then the locals that never really interacted with internationals because there wasn't a space to do that in. So the base of the mountain is 2 kilometers from the town that we lived in. And typically campgrounds wouldn't let people who weren't staying there, who weren't paying to stay, to come in. And so there was really wasn't a place for people to mingle and learn each other's culture and understand, you know, why would you come here from, you know, who knows, Sweden to climb this mountain? Why would you do that? So we were able to work through this coffee shop ministry, create that space. We ended up taking some of the local youth rock climbing, which was really neat to do, and then connected the rock climbers to a school that we were helping to kind of get started in a different town and a middle school that didn't exist in that area. And so it's just a really neat ministry. It's still going on today and it's called El Búho. Awesome. If anybody ever goes to Petrero Chico, go check out the owl. So yeah.
Very cool. And so during that time, you also learned Spanish. I mean, you're a Spanish speaker and all those pieces as well, which I think, again, speaks to this experience that you had that we're going to get to in just a second.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Gina, your most recent book, you've titled Separated by the Border, A Birth Mother, A Foster Mother, and A Migrant Child's 3,000-Mile Journey. Mm. And in the foreword by Michelle Warren, there was this quote that she put in there that I just kind of wanted to share with our listeners if they haven't read the book yet. I think it kind of gives a good overview of what this book is about. And at least it caught my attention. It says, family separation is also an issue for children. Those born to undocumented parents often suffer the pain and trauma of having parents deported, not to mention of living under that threat. Over 8 million U.S. citizens live with that fear for at least one family member. And according to the American Immigration Council, almost 6 million citizen children under the age of 18 live with a parent or family member who is undocumented. That, I mean, first and foremost, this book, it made it personal for me, even though I haven't personally, you know, gone through this like you have, but you have written this book. You've opened up your family and the story of your family and the birth mother and your foster daughter in a way that almost makes, it allows us to almost feel like we're taking this journey with you. And this is a staggering statistic. 6 million citizen children under the age of 18 live with an undocumented parent or family member. It just puts it into, it contextualizes it. It puts it into numbers and statistics and thoughts that go beyond the politics mm-hmm. that immigration has become in the U.S. Yeah. Maybe just start off by sharing a little bit. What was it like in writing this book? And well, first of all, living this out, but then also in writing this book.
Yeah. Thanks for that. It was a process writing this book. It was a very difficult, hard process because as you're kind of, you know, reeling with this information, those moments happened all along the journey. And the more you know about immigration in the States, the more you kind of feel that, you just feel overwhelmed by why is this so inhuman? You know, it's inhumane policies that happen to people and to their families. And, you know, as Christians, we care about the whole family, right? Like we're very pro-family. I believe that that's directly from God. And so to hear these different statistics, to read about different children, to do a lot of research on things that I just had no idea were happening, you know, to be face to face with the information that shows me that what happened to my foster daughter is not an anomaly. This is normal. Just broke me over and over again. Like, I think you can see that in the book where mm-hmm. I just fall apart and my faith kind of unravels in a way. And I think what happens is as we come face to face with our own privilege and power that we have as a Christians in the United States, because we are, you know, majority Christian nation. And then on top of that, as white people, as people with papers and documents and houses and all the stuff, your faith kind of has to unravel because you have to tear away the chaff of what has actually been indoctrinated in me as part of, you know, my culture that I thought was being a Christian, and what actually is being a Christian, and what does that look like? And so it was not an easy book to write by any means, but I think an important one. And I just really appreciate what you said, that you feel like you could kind of take the journey with me through the story, because there were definitely times where I questioned myself on why I was writing it and if I should be. Mm-hmm. And Andrew, as you mm-hmm. talked about, you know, we had talked about ethical storytelling. That was really important for me to do in this story, especially because it's not my story, at least part of it, right? And so, yeah, it becomes a really big, you know, dilemma in should the story get out or should it not? And for me, when Lupe gave me permission to share the story, she didn't just give me permission. She said that she wanted it to be shared so that others could know what people go through. That was the moment where I knew. And that was the moment I kept going back to throughout the journey to say, this is the story that she does want to tell. And it is worth telling, but it's definitely hard. So,
I will just say one of the things I appreciated so much about this book, and it's just apparent in all of your writing, I think, is you have a sense of honesty and transparency as you process things. So yes, I agree, Nate, it's like you're walking through this journey, but not just in the day-to-day what happened, but also the thought process of that, questioning yourself, that I think challenged me in those moments to go, where have I, maybe not in the same way, experienced this, but where do I need to have that same kind of honesty in questioning my motives or the reasons behind things? Or I just found that to be really challenging throughout this book. By the way, in the show notes, we will link this book so that you can find places to purchase it, encourage our listeners to read it. But for those that haven't read it, that can you give us just a sense of the characters and a really quick overview? You mentioned Lupe. So tell us who Lupe is. Tell us how you got connected with her, and just, again, not the whole story, because we want people to read it and you know, engage in it, but at least a little bit to know kind of what we're talking about in essence.
Yeah. So my husband and I decided to become foster parents in October of 2017. And it was in February that we were placed with Julia. So we met Julia first. She was 5 at the time and had been found wandering the streets in the county that we lived in. And the police had picked her up and brought her to DSS, to Department of Social Services. And so they, you know, we were already connected to them through being foster parents. And they knew that Andrew and I had lived in Mexico, so we both spoke Spanish. And essentially they said, just keep her for the weekend. ICE is going to come get her on Monday. And ICE is Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And so we just, you know, kind of assumed she would just be with us for the weekend. Well, ICE didn't show up, and then didn't show up again the following week in court. And so then she became part of foster care. So from that process, we didn't know a whole lot about her family. We had gotten different information and incorrect information. Finally, about, I think it was about 2 weeks into the process, we were able to make contact with her mom. Her mom had just returned to Honduras after being held as a hostage at the border in Mexico. And the two of them were separated, traveling up to, so they're both from Honduras. They traveled up through Guatemala into Mexico, made it to the border. And they traveled with a friend of theirs whose name was on the little girl's birth certificate as her stepdad. However, at the border, she was separated from the stepdad as well. So initially, prior to getting across the border, to getting into the United States, she was separated from her mom because of the smugglers took her, the mom, as a hostage because they decided they could make money off of her. And then she was separated from her stepdad from the U.S. government. And that was part of the family separation that had been going on for a lot longer than any of us knew about at the time.
Yeah.
And so she then became, you know, our foster daughter. And then we were working through kind of the foster care process to return her back to her family. So that's a quick wrap of the story. Yeah.
Which is so, I just think that the story incorporates so many different elements of life and challenges. So you get the experience of Lupe trying to get into the United States, and that experience itself is heartbreaking and challenging and uncomfortable because so many of us don't know all of the things that happen and the statistics that you bring out about instances of rape and hostages and all these kinds of things. Like, that is one story in and of itself. And then the story of you fostering this little girl who's been separated from her family and is trying to figure out what life is like. And I just found it to be such a captivating story that has challenged me to rethink some of the ways that we talk about immigration or think about immigration. And so when you were in Mexico, were there things in your experience in Mexico or things in your experience here in the United States that with Julia and her family that shaped the way that you think about immigration?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, obviously living in Mexico for, it was a little over 4 years, we understood at least to a degree the experience being an immigrant. I mean, essentially we were immigrants there. And, you know, there's a lot of different layers to that because we were still white. We still had, you know, American passports, which all the different layers of power kind of are in there as well. So, but we did understand what it's like, A, to be around people who don't speak your own language, and B, to not understand, you know, a culture. It took us a while to understand the Mexican culture. And I had lived in Honduras previously. And to be honest, for me personally, Mexican culture took longer for me to assimilate to, or however you want to say that, to really understand than Honduran culture did. And so, you know, having those experiences and understanding that there was even differences between Honduras and Mexico, I think were really important for this as well, to kind of be the family that we needed to be for Julia at the time that she was with us.
I'm going to read another quote. I have so many highlights and notes and quotes. I think, I mean, just throughout this book, but one of the things that, another one that jumped out at me was you said, the paragraph starts off with that God does not show favoritism. And then you go on to say that God sees beauty in the places where we've trained ourselves not to go. God sees beauty in the places we're scared of, in the people we'd rather not talk to, in the middle of messes we'd rather shy away from. That really stopped me in my tracks and again, forced me to process and think about that. And, you know, in your story, at what point did you figure out you were in one of these messes? You were in the middle of a mess. I mean, and I imagine there was probably a point where it was like, okay, we can't go back. We can't undo what we've already done and live our normal lives or whatever life, you know, if life was normal before.
Right.
But was there a point that you can think of or remember where, you know, you kind of went past that point of no return?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I think when ICE didn't show up in court the Monday that they were supposed to, right? So this was going to be a 3-day thing. I was like, okay, this is not good. And then, and Andrew, actually, my husband, he was like, oh, they're not going to show up next week either. And I was like, no, they will. They're the federal government. They're going to show up. You know, they have to do what they say they're going to do, right? Like, naive me.
We pay them, right? Their taxes. They have to, they have to do this.
Like, how are they going to leave a little 5-year-old girl just, you know, doing stranded? And then when they didn't show up that next Monday, I was like, okay, we're really in it. Like, we're really, really in this. And part of that mess for us was we had another foster girl that was staying with us at the time. And so we knew that our family couldn't handle having two foster kids because we had tried that before and, you know, kind of had different meltdowns happen, I think, with every single one of our family members. And so it was kind of this moment of like, all right, God, I don't see a path forward. I don't know how this is going to work. Like, you know, we've just discovered this boundary line. You know that it's there. Like, what are you going to do to make something happen? Because like, this is a really strange situation. There's not other foster parents in the area where both speak Spanish. If we are going to, you know, move her to another home, then we need it to probably be out of the county, maybe even out of the state. So what are you doing? She's already been with us for 2 weeks. Like, what's going on? You know, it was just like, and obviously foster parenting in general is a lot of like,
yeah,
oh goodness, what are we doing? What are we getting ourselves into? But yeah, and y'all know that too. So yeah, it was just this like this big moment of, okay, plan A did not happen. I don't even see where plan B can come from.
Yeah. So Gina, I think that immigration often gets politicized. Nate's already brought that up. Just even the term immigration automatically puts people's, you know, radars mm-hmm. up, and they have ideas and thoughts as to what that means. And it very quickly can devolve into conversations about laws and these things that don't make it personal. But you actually experienced something that was incredibly personal. This wasn't about laws. This was about a little girl that came into your home that, again, you didn't even recognize all of the different things that were happening with the family separation at the time and just how many different layers there were to that. Mm-hmm. So how do you respond to people, especially Christians, that say that immigration is just a political issue and not an issue that the church should be involved in? How does the church get involved in that? And then how do you respond to those people that say the church shouldn't be involved?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think for me, and, you know, obviously my faith is incredibly important to me. When we go back to Genesis 1:26, and we go back to the Imago Dei that's in every single human being, that is where I think the genesis of justice starts, right? Because when you look at someone else and the things that they're going through, let's just take the topic immigration. You look at the topic itself, then it's pretty easy to not see people as humans who are part of that topic. But if you look at the humans first, then you hear their stories, and it's impossible to not see the Imago Dei in them, especially as Christians. It's impossible not to see the Imago Dei in them and then fight for that, whatever it takes. And so I think what often happens in churches, especially in our politicized society right now, is that there's a lot of looking at issues rather than looking at people. And so what happens is those policies and laws come first. And I think we're taught as Christians that the Imago Dei comes first. I mean, it's the first chapter of the Bible that we're given, you know, yeah. That's got to come first. So,
yep. I love that. Mm-hmm. Connected to that, you talked about the Imago Dei, and that was one of the things that I loved. You know, oftentimes when I read books, I tend to underline a ton. But in this book, I found myself, it's just so narrative driven that I found myself reading very quickly through it. And so I ended up marking a lot at the end where you have a lot of different kind of where do we go from here? Mm-hmm. Well, what does the church do? You have a lot of great pieces in there. But one of the things you start with, and I just want to bring it out because I think it's incredibly important, and it touches on this idea of the Imago Dei. You say that you'll address some of the action steps in the What Can We Do section, but we'll start with the first action step here, intentionally becoming aware of the language we use and actively refraining from using dehumanizing language. If we truly believe the Imago Dei is imprinted on every human being, we can't continue to call other human beings by subhuman titles. As Jesus said, what comes out of our mouth is what defiles us, Matthew 15:11. That to me is just such a huge starting point. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what you're talking about. The church, the first step we don't have to deal with the laws and the policies. The first step should be treating people and using language that treats people as humans.
That's right.
So what does that look like? I mean, how does the church do that?
Yeah, well, I think, again, anytime that we're talking about immigration, we're not just talking about the issue. Like I've heard really awful things said from the pulpit about immigrants. I've heard human beings called illegal, which in my view is not okay. That's dehumanizing language. No Absolutely. Human being can be illegal, and a lot of other things as well. And, you know, we talk about, on the one hand, we say the power of life and death is in the tongue. And on the other hand, we're calling people, again, by these subhuman names. It doesn't make sense. There's a lot of cognitive dissonance that we've got to work through as the church. But it starts with naming people. It starts with using their names. Yeah. It starts with recognizing that they are actual human beings, and this is their family, and that there are stories to that. I think another big thing, just in general, when we're talking about immigration and foster care, is naming the family and the family unit, because often we kind of separate the child and say, oh, the child is innocent, and the child, you know, all these things kind of belong to the child, but then we don't bring the parents in with that either. And that's really a big thing for me. When it comes to justice, you know, whether it's foster care and you've got biological parents who are dealing with parenting classes or whatever it is that they're going through, the family as a whole is a family that God has imprinted his, you know, God's imprint on. And so we need to be pro-family in that way. And immigration and foster care and adoption, all of those things, we have to keep that in the forefront of our minds when we're talking about, you know, not being dehumanizing. I think it's really easy to place children up on a pedestal and then the parents kind of down lower than humans. And I think it's really important that we're seeing everyone there as a human that's made in the image of God.
I love that.
Gina, you wrapped up the book nicely, the story nicely, but as we're probably all aware, things don't necessarily always just stop, yeah. you know, after you are done writing. Yeah. So what's happened with this story since you finished the book?
Yeah. So, you know, COVID obviously has a huge impact on their family. I keep up with them pretty regularly, and it's been a really difficult time for them finding jobs, keeping jobs, you know, different people in their community that are, you know, also desperate and struggling to find food. There was a lot of curfews, so they couldn't go out to find jobs. And so it's been a really difficult, economically speaking, on them. And of course, economics has its own, you know, ripple effect into psychology and all that. So that's been really challenging. Julia she turned 8 recently, so that was really exciting. She had a birthday party with her church, and that was really neat to see pictures from. And she's doing really well in school, which is awesome to hear. So yeah, has happened. Life still goes on and it's still difficult. You know, we're still keeping in touch and trying to help out when we can. So,
yeah. So this book, again, one of the things I mentioned about this, I love that it's weaving all of these different stories together, and it's not one single conversation. It's a few different conversations that are woven together, and we hear both about immigration and also about fostering and your experience fostering and the challenges of that and the heartbreak that comes with that. You shared a little bit about the challenge of having 2 kids in the house and making decisions about who to support and how to support and what that looks like. Mm-hmm. But I was reminded as I read this book that in your last book, A Smoldering Wick, you had a similar challenge to the American church. And it's one of the things I loved about the book is, you know, the book is about these short-term trips, people going and serving, but you really say that, like, that shouldn't be the end all of what we do, that actually our lives should be on mission, should be engaged in work here. And I love that you didn't come up with something simple like, oh, you should serve at a food pantry once a quarter. You actually challenged people to something very difficult, which is fostering. You have a whole chapter about when you serve globally, you should also be serving locally. And one of the ways we can do that is by supporting families and fostering. Yeah. Now you've had a really complicated experience with that, you know, and that was all written before this experience with Julia. So how does this experience now kind of shape those previous comments and shape kind of your thoughts that you shared in the book?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, we're always as human beings, we're always evolving, right? We have different ideas and they change and kind of shape differently as we mature. And it's kind of hard to do that when you're an author and you put your words in print forever, right? But I will say that, you know, even in what I had said before, I think I stick by it in that one of the things that I think a lot of missions has kind of gone under fire for lately is like, okay, you'll adopt overseas or you'll do this overseas, but will you paint a house? Will you paint your neighbor's house, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, would they even want you to, right? So like, so just trying to think through, like, what is it that I'm doing? And am I doing it just because this is kind of like a quote unquote exotic experience for me?
Yes.
And I therefore think that, you know, so somehow God is a part of that exotic experience that he's not necessarily a part of the mundane experiences that I'm having at home. And so I think my challenge is constantly like, if you are going to go do this overseas, what's stopping you from doing it here now? And then kind of question those things and kind of, you know, go on the rabbit trail of where those questions lead you, because oftentimes it turns into, well, I don't know that I can commit at home, because committing at home is a whole lifestyle change, like we talked about. And that's, you know, missions trip is a 10-day thing. I can do that for 10 days, right? And then it's like, okay, well, maybe there's something there that you need to, you know, bring to God and kind of filter through what is real here, what is of God here, and what is just me wanting to have this grand experience where I think that God's going to show up, right? And so fostering, I still hold on to that. Like I love talking to foster parents. I think they're one of my favorite audiences to talk to, because it is like you were saying earlier, I am very real in the book about very real. Sometimes I'm like, why did I say that? But yeah, fostering is quite the challenge. And that doesn't mean that it's not one worthwhile, right? I think so much of what we do in our faith walk is the difficult stuff brings us to a new revelation of who God is. And so I would definitely say that people, and I say this in the Smoldering Wick too, like, be aware of your own boundary lines, understand, you know, what you're getting into. Don't assume this is going to be some amazing, wonderful thing that's, you know, not going to have any issues or troubles. But I would love to see the church really, and I have seen this in different areas where the church just kind of decides like it's going to be a fostering church and it's going to wrap around foster parents and it's going to work on this, because the reality is in our country, there are so many orphans in the sense of one parent is not in their life. And you know, we often talk about orphan care worldwide, but don't often talk about it here in the States. And we have a really, you know, it's definitely a broken system, but in a lot of ways, it's a better system than not having that system at all.
Yeah.
We should get involved in it as the church.
Yeah. I think that, you know, your challenge of, you know, if you're willing to go on a 10-day trip, but you're not willing to change your lifestyle here, you should be questioning that, is a really good one. And I'll go so far as to say, I think that people during COVID who feel like missions has ended because they can't travel, then you probably should reevaluate what missions is in your life. Because good. If that's the only thing that you believe that missions is, you know, maybe this was actually an opportunity for you to engage more in your community,
Right.
And so I think I think you're exactly right. We have to be willing to analyze that and really ask those hard questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Gina, to wrap up our time together, one of the questions we always like to end with is, because this is called a World of Good podcast, what good is God doing in your world today?
Yeah, I love that question. That's so good. It's been a while after we were fostering for a while and we moved to Chattanooga, then we moved back here. It's been a while of like not really having steady practices that I can, like faith practices that I can be a part of. And so we've now been in this house for, I think it's like 3 or 4 months, and we're starting to see some of those things happen. And to me, I look back on this time and I'm just so grateful for that. It sounds really small, but it's such a huge thing for me to like have these steady things that I can look forward to every day. There's a prayer that I say over my kids every day before I drop them off at school. It's the same one. And when my daughter doesn't hear me say it, because I've, you know, gotten wrapped up in our conversation on the way there, she always reminds me. She says, "Hey, what about that thing that you do every day?" And I was like, "Oh, I love that. You want that." Yeah. And then every Wednesday we have like our Sabbath is our game night. And so that's just been really fun to be a part of. And the kids are so excited about it, even though, you know, obviously with COVID, screens are like so much more a part of life than they ever have been before. And so it's just really neat to kind of see some of these little like practices that we're finally in a place where we can start doing. This has been just beautiful and good.
That's awesome. Well, Gina, we're so thankful that you joined us for this conversation. Very challenging. The book was challenging. I hope people will pick up a copy of it, both this book and her previous book, A Smoldering Wick, and whatever books you come out with in the future. We're excited to see those as well.
Thank you.
You challenge us in the way that you think, and we're just so grateful that you would spend a little time with us today, Sharon.
Thanks so much. It's so great to see both of you.
Yeah. Thank you, Gina.
Yeah. Take care.
Thanks for listening to A World of Good. A World of Good is a podcast production of Global Strategy and Church of God Ministries. Our theme song is Colorado by Leo Flores. If you want to join the conversation, visit us at Twitter at A World of Good Pod, on Instagram, A World of Good Podcast, or visit our website, chogglobal.org/A World of Good. And join us next time as we share more stories of good from around the world.